Last night when we did the PLU liturgy, we did not sing the offertory song, which some consider one of the more beautiful ones, and then I was thinking we could sing it through this morning, if we have time, perhaps. I want to just share a little excerpt from, this is a book that's in the bookstore, To Dance with God, Family Ritual and Community Celebration. It's a real nice treatment of some of the different liturgical seasons, but has a wonderful story at the beginning, just one paragraph. Some years ago, I spent an afternoon caught up in a piece of sewing I was doing. The wastebasket near my sewing machine was filled with scraps of fabric cut away from my project. This basket of discards was a fascination to my daughter, Annika, who at the time was not yet 4 years old. She rooted through the scraps, searching out the long, bright strips, collected them to herself, and went off. When I took a moment to check on her, I tracked her whereabouts to the back garden, where I found her sitting in the grass with a long pole. She was affixing the scraps to the top of the pole with great sticky wads of tape. She said, "I'm making a banner for a procession. I need a procession so that God will come down and dance with us." With that, she solemnly lifted her banner to flutter in the wind, and slowly she began to dance. I'm going to turn it over to each of you to do some of your loose ends. Phyllis said she would do some of her do's and don'ts that she had mentioned earlier, and assorted other comments.
Let me start. Well, for someone who claims to be nonverbal, I seem to have a lot of words I want to give to you today. These are some excerpts from this book, which I do recommend, Davies' book on liturgical dance. It has a history of dance in the church, and it has some practical applications. And a couple of comments I want to really quickly read about dance and movement, that it frees the creative impulses, releases the imagination and helps develop it, encourages spontaneity, initiative, judgment, courage, means of expression like any other form of communication. I'm just going to throw these things out without commenting on them, folks. We worship in two ways, from human beings to God and from God to human beings. Now, this is this person's thought about worship. And in the first instance, worship is expressive from human beings to God. In the second, it's impressive. And dance can be both, because it, as an impressive form, we can see maybe how to worship bodily, which certainly we experienced last night in a most spontaneous and beautiful way. I would like you to think, and I, as I'm reading these things, that, well, I'll come to that in a minute. Words, art, sacraments, now this is from Judith Rock, performer as priest and prophet. All three arise from the glorious, the unaccountable, the creating human body, mind, spirit that is the image of God. Dance reminds us that everything comes down finally to the human act, unadorned by explanation or excuse. Everything we know and do, including worship and theology, arises in and is mediated through our bodies. It's important to use movement to re-embody our thinking. Thought is as rooted as movement in muscle, blood, and bone. Another comment. If, as the church has always held, the holy is beyond all human efforts to fully understand and describe, then we need to use and learn from all our ways of knowing and perceiving if we are to get anywhere at all on our spiritual journey. The biblical record, we have the reflection of human experience of God, two perceptions of who God is and what God does in the world. God is the creator, maker of inexhaustible diversity and beauty. And God is the questioner, challenging us, surprising us, calling us beyond complacency. You know, just kind of a recap of everything we've been talking about and doing in this time together. It occurs to me that Carol made a very important statement last night about language. And of course, I've lost all my notes, so I don't really know what I'm going to say anymore. Language, our language reflects our experience and also shapes it. Our movement language reflects our experience and also shapes it. And we have in our culture an amazingly impoverished movement language because we have been taught from the time we are about three that movement is a childish activity and we need to leave it behind us. And I hope that you have enjoyed seeing Daniel and Andrew as I have enjoyed seeing them. And I have challenged Steve and Jennifer to find ways to allow those children to be as beautiful as they grow into their adulthood as they are now in their childhood, in the way they use their bodies. Andrew is the only one who knows how to sit in these chairs. I hope you've watched him. I mean, he sits back and crosses his legs and is very, very comfortable. And
they were clearly made
for a body that size. Yeah. There's just no question in my mind, but that is what these chairs ought to be used for. Jose Limon, one of our very I'm sorry, not Jose Limon, but Ted Shawn, one of our very famous male dancers, talked about wanting to somehow bring into being a physically literate adult population. And it would be wonderful if somehow the church could be a part of that. Let me make some comments about movement in worship that I'd like to kind of tie together here. You have movement in worship all the time, and we know that. I mean, the leadership moves, our chancel prancing. That's movement. You need to take a look at that. How do you pattern that? And I don't really want to imply that that's what you all do, but the congregation moves, the choir moves. And you can, if you choose, want to develop a movement choir and even bring in liturgical dancers. Now, liturgical dancers are generally trained dancers, and they can do all kinds of things. They can illustrate scripture. We didn't do any of that. You haven't seen that in this time together, it seems to me. We didn't do any straight illustration of scripture.
Did a psalm.
We've done psalms. Well, that's my next one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Scripture.
And hymns and anthems. I mean, you've seen antiphon stuff, but we haven't done a whole hymn or an anthem either. Poetry, easy. I mean, not easy, but can be done. Abstract pieces. Again, you've not seen any of that. And that really then gets into the issue of whether you want to provide for your congregation movement that is comforting or movement that is challenging. And both of those things, of course, can be done. You've not seen anything particularly challenging in this time. What I have been doing has been fairly mild, gentle, and not intended to shock people, because that's just not my approach. But there are people who do that. And if your congregation is prepared for it, it can be a wonderful, wonderful experience. That part of God the Questioner, dance can really do some wonderful things in that realm. And I have a little excerpt I'd like to read to you about that. Dance sermons. You saw one last night. Thrown together. But the story behind that is Carol handed that to me last summer, an hour and 45 minutes before the Vespers.
I got this idea on Sunday afternoon, only
and
like Phyllis came.
And so I just said, I mean, I either had to say yes or no, and so I improvised my way through.
You don't know how to say no.
I'm trying. I really am going to have to come to Holden to learn how to say no. I had a little bit more time last night, but the interesting... I mean, I'm curious about your response to that, because there was a whole lot of it in which there was no movement, and I don't know whether that was a problem for people. Good, because the intention, of course, was to allow for enough
I mean, and were you able to get all the words? I mean, that's the important thing, the integrity of that, so that the movement doesn't distract from the words.
Well, on the contrary, I remember it because of the rhyme.
Well, good, then it worked. You have to be a little...
You remembered it otherwise.
You have to be a little concerned about some trained dancers who might not understand that, that they want the dance to be seen, and so it's a little tricky. I mean,
the readers were great.
Weren't they wonderful? Yeah. Gee, I'm glad you even said something about them. I mean, I don't care about them. I mean, I was the one who was doing it.
I was telling Carol something. It was interesting being a reader because, like she was saying, sometimes you didn't know whether we should keep, I don't know, keep my eyes on the script or look around or kind of look at you or whatever. But it was interesting in reading, having off in my peripheral vision you dancing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was an interesting mm-hmm. experience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that could be in the congregation. The congregation is part of a dramatic reading or something where there is a dancer that's, you're not focusing only on the dancer, but you're focusing on the words, and it comes together that way, I think, through the word and the dance.
It's a powerful impact. Powerful impact, I think. Can be, anyway. Yeah, great. Well, and then, of course, there are movement prayers. We've not done any of those either. You know, to really move through the Lord's Prayer. There's, in this little book, a whole... You can learn how to do the Lord's Prayer. I'm not particularly excited about this version, but... and other prayers. Storytelling, which is really kind of drama, but you haven't seen any of that either here. I recently saw an absolutely marvelous presentation of the Hagar and Sarah story, which was beautifully done in movement and drama and music. Well, you can also create in your congregation a movement choir. You saw a hint of that the very first night when we just pulled together a bunch of people and did just a very, very brief gestural thing to the Marty Haugen Vespers. And that, of course, requires some real planning and commitment. If you want to do something like that, you really need to get people who are interested in making a commitment, and you need to provide them the time and the space and get someone. I think it's usually helpful to have some kind of professional leadership for a movement choir. They can be very effective folks. And if you can even begin with a small one, you know, just maybe three or four or five people who are interested in doing that and doing the kind of antiphonal stuff that we've done here, you might begin to get the congregation feeling better about what they can then do. And of course, a movement choir can essentially do everything that a trained dancer can do. I mean, all of those things that I just described. Well, now, what about the congregation? I mean, you know, normally what a congregation does is it processes, well, I don't know about your congregation, but it moves into the bus church, or it somehow moves into the sanctuary. It sits, it stands, it may genuflect, it may make the sign of the cross. It prays, and there are all sorts of things in there, and we haven't really talked about this, but we do have, I mean, what are the postures of prayer? You can do prayer with your head down, with your eyes closed, your hands together. You can do prayer with your head straight, your eyes open, your hands open. You can do prayer with your eyes up, with your arms up. You can do prayer kneeling. You can do prayer lying down on the floor, I mean, in a prone position. Normally, I guess we don't do that in our Protestant churches, but all of those things make different statements. And you may find times in your services where it might be useful to suggest a posture of prayer, because it might mean... They all have different meanings, and certainly the body responds differently to all of that. And I'm sorry we haven't had time just to do that, to go through those.
I've experienced that, not only do they make different statements, and what was the last thing you said? Different
feelings.
Yeah, that really, for me, affects the prayer. Doesn't just affect the body, but really, I think that's really striking if you can spend some time like in a meditation kind of setting, changing those postures as you go to experience how that changes the prayer.
Yeah, it might be fun to just have a real, even a loving kind of workshop with the congregation or members of the congregation on different postures of prayer. I guess my feeling is that you need to find some way to gently teach some of this stuff. That I don't feel it's that you can go in and just say, hey, you know, this is the way we're going to do it, but that's up to you all. Is it possible, let's look at maybe what you can consider, and again, I don't have any real solutions to this, folks, in terms of how to go about it. But certainly there maybe, are there times when you can really get your congregation to process? Is there some reason that they might want, you might want to have them really process into the church, Easter Sunday or Palm Sunday with the palms, and can they then even go into the holy area of the church? I mean, I will never forget the feeling I had when, as a younger person, I got to go up there for the first time, and. Just a thought that maybe there's some reason to do that. One of the very effective things that I've never done and never seen done, but was described to me last summer by Jerry Swanson, was on the offering, as the offering plate is carried up. And here again, you know, usually people will carry, I mean, there's sort of, you know, you walk up with the offering. It might be possible to get somebody to sweep up with the offering, you know, I mean, just a little bit of change in the timing of that. But what happened, the congregation rose in rows from the back to the front of the church, so that there was this wonderful lifting of energy as the offering was taken up. And sometimes I wish it didn't have to be the offering, but no, maybe the grapes or something. And then, of course, there would be an interesting effect if, as those people walk back, then people sat down in that. I mean, it's just
sort of like the wave.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen that done. They do that in Riverside Church.
Well, maybe that's where Jerry saw it. But it's got to have a very. I mean, it certainly sends the energy of the room in a direction.
What do they do again?
If you come from the back of the church, Tom, with the offering, the back row stands up as the offering plate passes. The next row, the next row, the next row.
So they're adding, they're all standing up by the end?
Right. Huh. Yeah.
Kind of like the wave.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Exactly. Everybody knows how to do that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The football.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, you're getting them all set to go home and watch the football game. Well.
That's how we do the opening on Super Bowl Sunday.
What a sermon you could do on that one. Oh, anyway. Well, and some of the movement things. It was interesting when we did the stuff around here, and all of that movement, those gestures on the psalm antiphons, were designed to be done sitting. And I had a conversation with one of the women in the community afterwards, and she really felt that it was difficult to do because of the being confined in the chairs, which I thought was interesting, because it had been designed to be done in chairs. People think they can't move when they sit down. This is one of the problems. Now, pews are even worse in some ways, and yet easier, because you certainly can do a lot more sideward stuff. So, what, holding hands, lifting hands up, lifting the heads up, reaching the arms up, breathing together. I think there's a wonderful thing you can do with a congregation if you just ask them to think of inhaling and exhaling together. It's such a metaphor. And I have done that in a congregation, and it was just really kind of neat. You know, you can arc with the head, and you can move the head, move the arms. You've done all those things. Wonder what would happen if you got up to sing a hymn and shifted from foot to foot. I don't know. I mean, you do it all the time. But does the congregation? I mean, and is there a way of doing that so that it doesn't become...
It's a good way to stay awake, too, sometimes.
Which is not a bad thing to consider, yeah.
When somebody's in addiction, we, after making the sign of the cross, we announce it ahead of time, but had everybody make the sign of the cross on one other person in silence with no words.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then had it posted. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I wish you'd make it bigger, you know? I mean, just that sense of sending it out into space.
Wait, see this. They say, oh, Townsend Holden.
The chancel prancing, the chancel dancing.
Why not? Why not? Why not? I mean, I think one of my missions in life is to really get people to take that whole image of the cross into the body. Because it is absolutely the most vulnerable, most amazing way for us to give and take.
Best person I've seen do that in Missoula is Ann Morawski, a former Lutheran pastor that did the sign of the cross. And, I know this is beautifully and very full.
You mean when she does the benediction?
The benediction, yeah. Oh. Yeah. Oh. I remember that.
Phyllis, in that book, do they have suggestions for gestures, different kinds of things?
There's a whole interesting passage in this book that gives you the meaning of some of the gestures, the historical meaning, natural, organic meaning. And I think it's really nice to look at that. I would hate to have you stifled by that, though. I mean, don't get stuck into the... But it's a good starting place.
Yeah.
I want to hurry, folks, because these people have got tons of things to say, too. Clapping hands, either with sound or without sound. You know, the whole notion of the symbols, which you can do without making any sound at all, has a wonderful thing through the body. You know, the Shakers have a tradition, and they had a tradition, of motioning songs and hymns. That was their phrase, motioning, which meant that they would physically do what the words said, so that they, had they been here for Let Us Break Bread Together on Our Knees the other night, would have done it. And if you think about what was said last night about God being a verb, there's a whole lot of action in verbs, and you might take a look at that, how you might, I mean, just thinking in about motioning, and of course movement prayers, if they're taught in some wonderful way, I think are beautiful ways of getting the congregation move. Antiphons, we've already talked about. Sitting arrangements, Steve has really worked hard to create a whole different, you want to talk about that?
I will slightly.
Okay. Now or later?
You're through.
Oh, okay. Well, that's really all I had on that now. Let me go quickly to my do's and don'ts. Do check your resources in your area. There is a little booklet that the Sacred Dance Guild puts out. You can all join the Sacred Dance Guild, of course. I don't know what the membership fees are for... A congregation, but there's a pamphlet here, and group, dance, church, $50 a year. Well, they will send you a whole bibliography of published books on, this is resources in sacred dance. It's got quite an extensive annotated bibliography, and you get their Sacred Dance Guild directory, which will tell you if there are any sacred dance people in your area, and you're welcome to take a look at this and take out addresses and names. And you get a journal. I think it's a quarterly journal with articles on liturgical dance. Some of them I've not terribly well written. You know, we're just not verbal people, okay? But some good stuff. And don't be afraid to use professionally trained dancers, but be as clear as you can about your communication with them, so that they can come into that situation with the sensitivity that's required, I believe. I've seen some professional dance people go into worship situations and just do what they want to do, and it has essentially nothing to do with the service, and I don't like that. I also happen to have a bias. I think modern dance trained dancers do better than the ballet trained people, because there's a whole different, the backgrounds of our training are so different. There is literature available to read. Trust your own instincts. Don't be afraid to do what you know you can do. Obviously, it's important to know your congregation and be gentle, I think, in initiating some of this stuff. I don't believe in the shock value approach. I do think that it's maybe useful to engage your congregation, get some people involved, you know, talk about it, get them involved before you actually do something, and like we did the other night. Be really thoughtful about space and time. Dance requires space, and here Steve and I are in wonderful incompatibility, and compatibility, in that dancers really don't like to have to work around objects. I mean, what we would like most of all is an open, clear space. We are pretty clumsy people when it comes to furniture and stuff in our way. We deal really well with just plain open space. We know that in churches we won't have that, but don't expect some marvelous, all right, this is my do list. Well, just think about the need for space and the need for time for dancers to work in that space. It isn't like music, folks, where the choir can stay in one place and do its thing. Dance the dancers need to know how to function in the space. Consider the integrity of the service. I've already talked about that. Consider a mix of movement possibilities. We've already talked about that too. Performance-oriented, participation-oriented. Consider the flow and pacing of the whole worship service. We've already talked about that. The use of artistic use of time, space, energy elements. Okay, my don't list. Don't expect miracles overnight. This is addressed to Carol Tomer particularly. Trying desperately to train her. But one of the things you really need to think about, and no one thinks about this. Musicians don't think about this. Painters don't think about this. Plain ordinary people don't think about this. The only people who really understand this are the dancers themselves, that we have to create what it is we're doing. We can't pick up a piece of music and read it and do it. And the creation, the time for the creating process needs to be considered, okay? I mean, you may think it comes easily. It doesn't. There's a lot of thought and work and stuff, and then there comes that moment, for me anyway, where I just say, okay, Carol, yes, and then it just, you know, then I go for it. But it would be, I mean, you know, you're not going to find people necessarily who are as crazy as I am, and therefore willing to just do it. So think about that you cannot expect instant choreography, all right? Don't expect the dance to make all the accommodations. Here again, we're talking about space, and we're also talking a little bit about music. Again, very often musicians don't understand the extent to which dancers really need to rehearse, and that requires more than one rehearsal with the music, more than one rehearsal with the sounds, because it takes time to get that stuff into the body. So don't expect the dancers to make all the accommodations. Don't forget that dancers are artists, that they'd really like to do their best. And that's all part of this needing time and space. Don't forget that the congregation really may need some body energizers somewhere in your service. I mean, that's just... maybe not only as you're planning your service, maybe don't only focus on the text of the music, but focus on the energy in the music that might be needed in certain places in the service. And don't expect to get something for nothing. If you're working with professional dancers, even with your own congregation, costuming is important. Props, if you need them. And that all costs money. And if you're thinking about professional dancers, they generally look at $50 to $100 per shot. So, okay. Can I have 5 more minutes? There's a wonderful thing I want to just share with you about a piece that Jose Limon did. This has to do with you and space and the funny things that we find out about it. It was an absolutely gorgeous piece that I saw on a regular stage, and it was his Requiem Mass that was choreographed after he had been to Warsaw, Poland, right after the war. And of course, Warsaw had been just essentially demolished by the Nazi army. And I've been fortunate to be there since and seen the rebuilding of that city. Wonderful country. Jose did an absolutely incredible piece. It started with a group of people on stage and the women being lifted up. They were being lifted up, and I don't know what the arm arrangement was, but they came out of the group, and these women being lifted up, and you got the whole sense of the Gothic cathedral. You really did. The eye just was taken up, and he created right there the Gothic cathedral. I later on saw that piece in a Gothic cathedral, and it didn't work at all. Simply didn't work at all. Because, you know, our eye went up, and oh, there we were in the cathedral, and we didn't want to come down and look. There it was. And it's just interesting how the spatial things are really, you know, we really need to attend to those. Metaphor and image and all that stuff that we've been kind of playing around with, I want to just read to you a quick description of a dance that I think I would have loved to have seen. This was done by a professional dancer, Paul Sonisardo, a duet called Abandoned Garden, about Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. Judas dances behind Jesus, carrying a powerful light. This is back to your wonderful light stuff, which he turns constantly on the Christ figure. The light streams over the audience, reminiscent of police interrogations, searchlights, floodlights, flashlights. Literary images such as the light of truth are called up for the viewer. The powerful movements of the two men, always in relationship, never at rest, further suggest startling images of evil making good sharply visible, of shadow defining light. During all of these associations, the watcher becomes more and more physically tense as tension builds in the phrases of the duet. By the end of the piece, the viewer is tired, having been involved body, mind, and spirit in the ancient battle and intimate relationship of good and evil. Powerful piece. I would love to have seen that. Back to the feet, which we sort of started out with. 100 years ago, Tuesday morning. Do think about it. Daniel was sitting here this morning during matins playing with his feet, and I suddenly thought, yeah, that's one of the first things that we do when we come into this world, when we finally can. I mean, we find our feet just absolutely fascinating. It would be so nice if we could get back to that fascination.
As you said on Tuesday, we ignore them and abuse them.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That
exactly.
Whole we do wave them up in the air, though, that's a real start.
well, and
good
we
reason
and,
for this thing.
And we do wash them, and I'm only regretful that we didn't find some way in this week together to do the foot washing for everybody. that we had.
Which we really wanted. We really wanted to do that this time.
And last, I just want to let you all know that I could not have done what I have done here without the wonderful support of these three fantastic people, and all of you, of course. But we spent a lot of time talking about the ideas, and it did not, it was not all mine. I may have organized that one Vespers finally by myself, but these people spent lots of midnight time listening to me and giving me tons of feedback, and of course you all have been just marvelous, and it's been a privilege and an honor to be a part of this. Thank you.
That's a hard act to follow.
It's the performer in me, Steve.
I just have three brief things to talk about, which I would gladly receive comments about. One about just some things where congregations can get started in terms of space uses, which we've talked about before. Second, to talk a little bit about kind of the role of the arts generally in the church, very briefly. And three, heaven. Okay. the first is that I think it's useful to put on this model we have started talking about, just touch the surface of, about the church being a servant rather than a shrine spatially in its being, and use that model to test out, like you drive a new car or try on new shoes, think about your spaces all the time with that model. Like you're saying, doing dance is an evolutionary process and it's a discovery process. Using space is the same way. Don't think of spaces as being fixed, because you in a sense take possession over years of these resources that you have, and you have to learn how to use them, and you try different things, and it's a continual process. It isn't fixed. You know, it doesn't drive up to the door, be unloaded from the truck like a washing machine or something, and then you just use it. You have to, and that's kind of the way we relate to objects a lot is kind of an appliance relationship in our world, and spaces don't work that way. And I might add that architects are usually thought of as being appliance dealers, or used car salesmen. And we try to get away from that we're really starting a process with people. So think first about the whole business of not internally, but think of, well, how do you approach your particular place? What happens at entry? Is it accessible? Is it friendly? What is all the imagery around saying to people who are already in the club? Or what does it say to people who aren't? What does it say to people who don't care? And just check those things out. Think about the exact linearity or message of that trip as you go into a building and settle someplace. And let's say in particular, worship spaces. Where is that line leading you? Does it line you up on the bus for a trip, and then when that's over, you walk back out the other way and out the door? Does it circulate you around so that you experience all those nice people who are there? Where does that process take you in terms of space? And along that line, you might want to think, well, what statement is being made about washing and baptism? Is it evident? Is it not? Can you see where it happens or not? Is the baptismal font behind a door and over at the side of the room, or is it something you have to walk around or trip over? Then second, what along that trip is the assembly place like? assuming even if you have a bus kind of arrangement, you might have find ways of working on bringing everybody together, de-emphasizing a two-room church so that you at least have a one-room space. For those of you that don't use all of your space packed all the time, it's really worth considering for social reasons as well as dance, is to open up as much space as you can where people can just mingle. Frequently we recommend that people take out like the last six rows of pews entirely. And not worry about the fact that the narthex is so small. Just get rid of the back pews. Because people are going to want to sit there first anyway. You don't want them to. So take them out. So people are forced to move forward, and then you try to get the ushers to be inside the room and not talking about football and their fixes. But that space is really needed. It's needed in the front, it's needed on the sides, it's needed in the back. And then that space can be used for dance, it can be used for assembly, and it also makes people feel more comfortable who may be uninitiated. Because as soon as you go into a space and you're like this with everyone and you don't have much room to wiggle, there's a kind of not a claustrophobic sense. I don't know what, no, I'm not sure what the right
sense would be. You freezes into its place.
You don't feel like there's a way out. You're trapped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was in City Lansing at University of Lutheran, the narthex and the nave are all one. There's really the only difference is no chairs in the gathering area in the back. So the movement is so natural.
And that's one of the steps you can take, is if there's an easy wall to take out between a narthex and the back of a worship space, get rid of it.
So when you're worshiping, you're all worshiping. When you're visiting or when you're in the back, you're all doing.
And if somebody needs to take a baby back there and walk around or something, fine. Crying rooms don't work anyway. Don't let people think narthexes are supposed to be crying rooms. So. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the idea of the first symbol, the first powerful image, is the fact that two or three are gathered together. So that assembly, just the way that works, is numero uno to consider. And it goes along with the idea of path. Table. Respect the table, because the table is the focus of communion. And we should always talk to people about it as a special locus for that sacrament. And be careful about it. I think it does need to be treated with some respect. But it, on the other hand, don't slip into shrinism. And I think it's fine for kids to be around communion tables, and I think it's fine to put your cup of coffee on it from time to time. I haven't been hit by lightning yet in doing that, but maybe next time.
We danced around it here and touched it. We didn't get on top of it. I would have a little problem with getting on top of the communion table.
Absolutely.
I haven't been hit by lightning yet.
Because it is, first of all, a worldly table. Pulpit. But be careful what you put on a table. The inevitable fight in the congregation is that it really is a flower stand. Okay. And you need to work that out with people. And it takes a long time. You have to provide other ways to use the rest of the space to display these creations of God. So you should allow yourself the freedom to move a lot of stuff around and explore the space. Put flowers in front of the pulpit, put flowers in front of the lectern, but respect the table as a table for communion.
But you know, we took our altar, we've done this for years at Thanksgiving, and built it up with a huge offering of harvest, and we have vegetables and fruits and pumpkins. Uh-huh. Wheat and boxes and baskets and stuff, and we just make a work of art of the table, and that becomes the focal point for the Thanksgiving service.
Uh-huh. Try it next time on the front steps, in front of the table. It does the same thing.
Well, the one thing about having it on the table is that more people can see it.
Right. But no, that's fine. I mean, I think that's a great thing to do at harvest time, is bring stuff into the room. Next, pulpit. I think pulpits are really, really extraordinarily important symbols as well, because of the spoken word emanates from that location. And because people need to see faces, you need to have someone who's speaking up high so everybody can comfortably see and they don't have to bend around behind necks to see what's happening. I think more churches should try thinking about, well, what parts of the spoken word need to be elevated to that position. I've always been curious why we read the gospel from scriptures down on the floor, but then the interpretation of the gospel is elevated. Okay. Shouldn't it be the other way around sometimes, or maybe from the same? I'm being just a devil's advocate here about this, but many churches are going to the mode of actually reading the gospel from the pulpit and preaching from the pulpit, or doing a gospel processional to bring the word into the middle of the people, and going to the pulpit for a sermon, or even some pastors really like to mingle in the crowd for sermons as well. I don't know whether that's good or bad, actually. I haven't thought that through. Next, this is getting really long. Next, besides the imagery of the assembly and dealing with those three principal elements, table, pulpit, font area, use color and light as your main materials spatially. I think we're at a time where we don't need to get hung up with a lot of other symbolism until we really understand how to use those things effectively. When you do banners, do big ones that have a lot of color. And then they'll be more beautiful anyway with the artistry that you locally have. So I think those are kind of the basic suggestions I have about just using spaces more effectively. And at the same time, think about kind of the social realities of how people use the whole church building. That's just as important, I think, for the life of the church as the worship space. You might encourage people as well, if you have a bus church arrangement, to know that it's okay to come into that space from other locations than the back. Do everything possible for people to know that it's okay to come in the side if you have a parish hall attached to the side. And then you come in that way and you know that that's just as important an entrance as out the back way. The next thing I wanted to just briefly touch is that I think one emphasis, without doubt, is that the arts have such a significant role in worship and the life of the church because, like our own simulations of the wonders of creation, through the arts we have a means for dealing with things that go beyond speech and beyond verbalization. And points have been made time and time again that perhaps only through the mysteries of beauty can we parallel a touch, in a sense, our wonder and awe about the mysterious. And rather than thinking of us building shrine-like spaces that we generate awe and inspiration and focus and all that, I think we have to shift that from being object-oriented to simply dealing with all aspects of beauty. Beauty within ourselves, beauty within the assembled group, through music, dance, art, speech, language. And I think it's pretty evident too that that's often thought of as the frosting on the cake. You know, these other things are more basic. I think we just need to try to flip that over and say, these experiences are basic. They're the important ones. And I learned that most significantly when I was working with poor people in Appalachia, because I'd go into these hillbilly shacks helping people with their houses, and the outside of hillbilly shacks are like what you see in the, you know, Life magazine about Appalachia. When you go inside, it's a totally different world, because you find people with incredible cleanliness and respect for their family. And I would see poor people's houses without any furniture, with art on the walls. And it just shocked me, because this was my image of the hillbilly doll from the media. But to them, that made up for the fact that they really had no control over how muddy the yard was going to be and how many junk cars the neighbors let stay there. So I think that role of art is central, and we've lost that, and we have to recover it. And last, because I don't want to take more than 15 minutes here, I do think we have to figure out about heaven and make some clear statements, or more clear statements, about is this a place or isn't it? Or we need to say to people, well, is this a mythopoeic expression that's part of our faith? But I'm awed by how frequently we use the imagery of heaven as a place. We use it, it's still in our Lord's Prayer, even if we take out our Father. We have heaven analogies. We talk about the grace coming down. We talk about... I really need help still finding out about what place heaven is. I think I'm interested in this because there seems to be some linkage with heaven out there and deferred interest in how we deal with other people. The emphasis on the afterlife in our faith, maybe even being linked with going to heaven sometime later, I think it's had a profound effect on the way we think about how we live in our spaces, how we use our spaces, how we relate to each other. And so I'm hopeful that this week I've given you enough chance to find an answer to this and begin to look at the stars. Heaven once was described just as that, as the heavens, the right above the dome of the sky was heaven. And that's the analogy the terminology is still stuck in that. One of the source books that I find interesting is I just barely finished reading and can't quite understand the last chapter, reading Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, which ought to be basic reading because it deals with whether or not there is a God from a mathematician's standpoint, who understands everything there is you want to know about black holes and how the universe was built. But you can guarantee yourself that if you read science, or if your children learn science in school, the astronauts didn't find heaven when they went up. Stephen Hawking can describe mathematically how far you can go out in the universe in terms of billions and billions of light years. They haven't seen heaven yet. It could be some kind of a black hole, you know, that doesn't show up with our data. So it could be a good sermon topic for you guys. You know, think of, could heaven be a black hole, or that our neurons, that our sensory system can't pick up. And ultimately, it's going to affect the way we design our churches to some degree, to get that straightened out. Even if we simply say that heaven is this, and heaven is like this, which our parables talk about and our poetry does. And Julia, you had found a nice piece that is one person's expression about heaven.
Yeah, this is a book by Gerhard Frost, A Treasury of Meditations, and it's called Seasons of a Lifetime. And it's just simply entitled Heaven, and it really got me thinking and actually kind of comforting to me, anyway. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. She held her father's hand as they boarded the West Flying Plane, skipping along the carpeted ramp, her feet hardly touching the floor. Where are we going? He asked her affectionately. To Grandma's, was her instant reply. She didn't say to Bozeman or Billings or Portland. She saw a face, not a place. Father, he said, he too saw a face. In dying, he found his way home. Into your hands, your future, your presence, I commit my spirit. Perhaps heaven isn't a place, but a face.
And when I figure out where heaven is, I kind of have the expectation that whatever happens there will be a lot like this week has been. Mm-hmm. Folks.
Can I show room for just a second?
Did some work on this a little bit this week because you asked the question the first time you spoke, and I listened to a tape and did some reading, and I don't know if it's where heaven is or when heaven is, but in the connection with worship and just the rich scriptural text that we have, you know, the text when it says the kingdom of heaven is near. And the dream of the Old Testament prophets, the Messianic kingdom, or the Messiah coming, they didn't know it, but being fulfilled in Christ. And when John the Baptist, in prison, asks his followers to go and ask Jesus, are you he is to come, or shall we look for another? And his response, and go and tell that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, and the poor have good news to preach to them. I think there's a connection there with heaven. And then, where is it? Where we face the paradox of living as God's redeemed people in a world that is still groaning in travail. Where we receive a foretaste of the feast to come. Where the blind see and the deaf hear. Where swords are beaten into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, where there is neither Jew nor Greek, male, female, slave, free, where the future is already here in the death and resurrection of Christ, where two or three are gathered in the midst, and Christ is in the midst, where the light shines in the darkness and the darkness hasn't overcome it, where heaven and earth meet, and God's people pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Where people are freed from bondage of any kind. Where people can praise God with timbrel and dance. Where people do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with God. Where justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Where joyful noises are made, where we come into God's presence with singing. And then three psalm quotes. Where God does not deal with us according to our sins, where God's word is a lamp to our feet and a light to our paths, and the one I like best of all, where those who sow in tears reap with shouts of joy. Psalm 26. That's really all from the scripture. Right? When heaven is or where heaven is, either one.
Actually, I thought I'd like to reword your question, which is not where heaven is, but where the kingdom of God is. And I don't think those are necessarily the same things. Some people would confuse those.
But, yes.
And architecturally, I wonder whether the implications are that the windows that are put in a church are not those ones up there that are coming down on the people, but the ones on the people's level so they can look out where the lame, the deaf, and the blind are, and where the Great Commission sends us all off.
And maybe it's not either or.
No, that's true.
Maybe it's both. Yeah. Commissioning and ascending.
Yeah.
Well, there we are. We're back into the
That's right.
Which sometimes are abstracted to think of as the vertical dimension and the horizontal dimension. You relate to people horizontally. You relate to but the distinction is frequently made that you relate to God vertically and you relate to people horizontally. And I think that's a shame.
Those are exclusive.
Yeah, right. That's my point about heaven. Okay.
That's why the pulpits are up high.
Yeah, Jesus didn't talk too much about heaven. He talked a lot about things.
So. No, he didn't. Right. Somebody manufactured heaven.
And what text do we hear probably most often preached at funeral sermons? It's, I will go and prepare a room for you, John 14. In that very same chapter, John uses the very same Greek word for God and Jesus dwelling in us. The very same word. Business of dwelling is so crucial in the Gospel of John. It's all over the place. I think that's John's concept of kingdom.
Sometimes I think heaven is my preschool room. Where that seems very simple, you know, simplistic to say that, but that's where I see in 4 and 5 year olds true forgiveness and acceptance. That's what I think.
And I'd add to that, I think it's also preschool chapel.
Yeah.
I think.
My thoughts on heaven are, they're kind of different. I have a tendency to think that my visions and my dreams are as much of a reality as what this is. You know, this is a reality, but also that other stuff that I experience, you know, when my eyes are closed or when I'm sleeping or even when my eyes are open, and sometimes I go, wow. And I think, like the other night I went up to Carol's for the, you know, we had a little social thing, and then after that I put on my coat and went out and went under the stars and just waited. And pretty soon I just had these visions of everybody leaving their body and coming out and dancing together, you know, and without any inhibitions and just loving each other. And to me, heaven is where our spirits blend in together and enjoy each other, and in my vision world. So, I don't know, I think the body just passes on. I know that we die, and the reality of the body, I don't think is the only reality that we experience. You know, it's a matter of, do you allow for the space for you to experience some of these other realities that can come up?
So. But have you seen the movie Places in the Heart?
Yeah.
I still think that final scene.
Yeah.
It's passing Grandma around to each other is clearly one of the most powerful. And you know, yesterday when I was having to work and couldn't be singing the alternative liturgies with you, I was sitting over here, you know, having this sideways view of everyone sort of get scrunched around singing. It had the same sense to me. It's just sort of this flash of again, just wow. Kind of earnestly gathered around singing.
Yeah.
Sort of the places in the heart sing.
Another one to me was the, what's this? It's named after a flower. The latest.
Steel
Magnolias. The scene at the cemetery after the funeral. And the tears and laughter. Mm-hmm. And the community that was down there, the grieving, the support was just powerful. You went from tears to laughter, just like that.
1 second.
Just powerful.
The end of Driving Miss Daisy. Have you all seen that?
Yes. What is it?
The end of it, the very last scene.
Don't tell me what it is.
Okay.
What's
the end of it? Driving Miss Daisy. It's
St-
Steve, what is your experience of heaven, not what you read?
Well, I guess I think of it more in light of the things that people have said here too about myself. A verb, a time, a way of being, not as a place.
Yeah.
You did make a comment when you started the don't think of spaces as being fixed.
In terms of you know, your shrine and servant words, we need those shrines too. And I wonder whether, because those can be powerful places. I'm not sure they're the places that the whole body of the congregation needs to be worshiping in. Wouldn't it be nice, like in my last church, we took some space to make into a small chapel that people could go when they needed to be introspective and pray and all that. But that was different from the worship space.
I would disagree, because I think it's important to have meditation spaces that are beautiful and lovely and engaging. But I think shrine qualities is object worship. That's what I would say. It's object worship rather than.
Well, we may be interpreting that differently.
Yeah, so it's a different way we're using the word. Yeah. So I agree with what you're saying, but I wouldn't want that to be called a shrine. Yeah.
I think if you sit with a flower, you're not worshiping it necessarily, but appreciating it, you know, loving it.
Oh, true. But I bring this up because in working with churches, I find that there is almost an unusual attachment to the image we have, let's say, of a chancel.
Oh, sure.
The altar, the candles, the cross on the wall.
The last one.
And those things are being worshipped sometimes. I'm really afraid.
I like the idea. Well, hold on, it's here too. There's many places you can go to sit and read or sit and be quiet, and, apart from a set worship space. Mm-hmm. There's places. Yeah. And if we look at churches, in one way, it's sanctuary. And people can find sanctuary within the building itself in different places, nooks and crannies or whatever. Whether it's mainly with other people or just being by yourself, but, or reflection, I think, too.
I bet you like eternal lights, don't you?
Oh, I think they're useful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the image of the processional cross is so much better than a fixed one, because the cross enters with the folks and departs with them. So I don't care for eternal lights.
I don't care for them in spaces, but as the Catholics use them to represent the consecrated presence of the hosts, that's a little bit different use. Mm-hmm. than just having a red light in a corner of a room. Mm-hmm. Which the meaning is gone from that. That's the problem. There's nothing wrong with the light. It's just...
Well, it seems appropriate to have ended with this discussion. I have just a few quotes from a few other authors that I haven't talked a great deal about, and then a few final comments of my own. And these are engaging all of the various things we've discussed this week. There's a book I didn't show you that's very worthwhile for the church musician called The Church Musician by Paul Westermeyer. Paul is the man I mentioned earlier who will now be going to Lutheran Northwestern Seminary full-time in the area of worship. And it's about time one of our seminaries has a person in a position like this. This is a book that is both theoretical and practical, probably more practical than theoretical. But there's a few things I just wanted to quote by him. He calls the leader of the music in the church the cantor, the leader of the people's song. And it's a word I think that's worth looking at. He talks about that here. First, the cantor is serving a specific people. Your responsibility as cantor is to allow that song, the song of that specific people, to find expression. That is the ideal. This is not to suggest that there are no standards. The church is, as a community of grace, however, begins with grace, not with the law. Second, the cantor's craft must be exercised with kindness and compassion. Music is for people. People are not for music. Well worth keeping in mind. Luther on growth, and we talked about that before too, how important it is to start where the folks are, but then also growth is a part of that. Oh, I have that in here. It's all scattered all over the place. This quote of Luther makes Lutherans who don't like sanctification language a little nervous, but nevertheless, this is Luther. This life is not being devout, but becoming devout. Not being devout, but becoming devout. Not being whole, but becoming whole. Not a rest, but an exercise. We are not yet, but we shall be. It is not the end, but the way. And that also applies to church music. Then Johansson, the man whose work I dealt with yesterday. Here he's quoting Henry Grady Davis. This has to do with mystery and awe. Theology expresses itself not only in language, which is the chief medium of the professional theologian. Theology expresses itself also in the material forms, which are the medium of the visual arts, including architecture, and in the audible forms, which are the medium of the musician. Visual arts also would be dance.
Okay.
And the other arts. And the other arts. Johansson again. A church is not an organization that merely reflects people in their cultural context. That would be the descriptive aspect of the church. It also reflects the God whom they serve. The church is not society's witness about God. It is God's witness to society. Eric Routley, who was earlier, a decade ago, my mentor, is now dead, died prematurely. This talks about worship as conversation. Between any two or more people, there must be a restraining of natural impulses or spontaneity, for once these restraints are withdrawn, civilized life cannot continue. Assertiveness talks, modesty listens. The best church musicians have always been the best listeners. When the precentor of Coventry Cathedral writes so memorably in his booklet, Evensong in Coventry Cathedral, that the church's worship is a conversation which began long before you were born and will continue long after you are dead, he is saying exactly what we need at this moment. The great church musicians listen to the conversation already going on before joining in it. Karl Barth.
What does it mean to die prematurely?
he was about 60. I would call that premature.
Me too.
Karl Barth.
What we can and must say quite confidently is that the community which does not sing is not the community. And where it cannot sing in living speech, or only archaically in repetition of the modes and texts of the past, where it does not really sing, but signs and mumbles spasmodically, shamefacedly, and with ill grace, it can be at best only a troubled community, which is not sure of its cause, and of whose ministry and witness there can be no great expectation. The praise of God, which finds its concrete culmination in the singing of the community, is one of the indispensable basic forms of the ministry of the community. And C.S. Lewis did not like church music. He called hymns of the church the church's gang songs. And that's well worth keeping in mind. That divides us. We define ourselves and our allegiances by the kinds of music we sing.
Separates us from others.
Yeah, it certainly does. But this is very well put. I'll try to fiddle with the language here, so please allow for that ill grace. This is entitled Church Music. There are two musical situations on which I think we can be confident that a blessing rests. One is where a priest or an organist, themselves people of trained and delicate taste, humbly and charitably sacrifice their own aesthetically right desires and give the people humbler and coarser fare than they would wish, in a belief, even as it may be the erroneous belief, that they can thus bring them to God. The other, this is the other blessing, where blessing rests. The other is where the stupid and unmusical lay people humbly and patiently and above all silently listen to music which they cannot or cannot fully appreciate in the belief that it somehow glorifies God, and if it does not edify them, this must be their own defect. Neither such a highbrow nor such a lowbrow can be far out of the way, that is, far out of the way of grace. To both, church music will have been a means of grace, not the music they have liked, but the music they have disliked. They have both offered, both sacrificed, their taste in the fullest sense. But where the opposite situation arises, where the musician is filled with pride of skill or the virus of emulation and looks with contempt on the unappreciative congregation, or where the unmusical, complacently entrenched in their own ignorance and conservatism, look with the restless and resentful hostility of an inferiority complex on all who would try to improve their taste, there we may be sure all that both offer is unblessed, and the spirit that moves them is not the Holy Ghost. If we could only all use words like that. A couple other things. One of the things we posited early on is that worship is evangelism. That was Pat Kiefer. I would just like to say that as far as I'm concerned, worship is worship. And that anything that it tries to use worship for any other means to an end is a manipulation of worship. That is not to say that witness does not come out of worship, but I get fearful of using worship for any other thing. How many times do we design our worship services to get us all puffed up for Stewardship Sunday, for example, or other kinds of things like that?
I remember the Jesus Freak days, you know, when they had all the tents and everything, and you go to these revival type of things, and they, at the end of the service, invite people to come down, you know, to be saved, and I remember the tremendous guilt I would have when I go to these things, you know, just for the fun of being there, when they would say, you have to come on down now, you know, and I'd see all these people doing that. I think that's wrong.
Yeah. Sometimes we try to manipulate people emotionally.
Yeah.
And musicians are very, very guilty of that. I think the problem, in quotes, with church music and the problem with worship in general is the problem of the church. And that is that we're lukewarm and we're not the disciples that we're called to be, but we want too much to be entertained and to be made to feel good. And I think that we're put too much emphasis on, or too much responsibility in what worship needs to do when it's the responsibility of the whole church to witness. As a pastor, I feel so much responsibility to go out and be knocking on doors, and I say, hey, this is the calling of the whole congregation, not just me. And I think that whole business is appropriate. So I get nervous when we say worship is evangelism or must be attractive. It's not to say that it doesn't have to have a place for the stranger. I mentioned the title, We Drink from Our Own Wells. I just want to write graphically and review what my wells have been. My first well was my Norwegian pietism that I came through very naturally from my roots, that I plugged off very effectively while I was doing my very formal training. When I started digging a well of what I might call the German, the high Baroque church music that I thought was just marvelous, and going back to Schütz and all the way culminating in Bach and 20th century German, this is the real classical literature, and for me that well goes very, very deep. I don't know where the bottom of that is. At the same time, when I was a teenager and in college, I was on folk teams and doing that kind of stuff, which is in a sense another kind of pietism. And I think a lot of the worship that happens here is very pietistic in the good sense. And so there's an overlap there, that pietism, and that goes down somewhere. I kind of cut that off too. Then I mentioned the English choral school that goes, there's no bottom there. I get a little nervous about that because so much of that tends to be otherworldly and try to transform us into this other place or transport us to this other place. But this is basically who I am. I'm now allowing myself to also sink this root very deep. But I think as churches we need to, and as leaders of our churches, need to decide what well our congregation drinks from. And I think they all do have a well.
They sort of look like an organ pipe.
I think our congregations do all have wells, and that's one of the reasons we need to listen to our folks and find out who they are. As pastors and as musicians and any other leader. And as Kenan Callahan wrote in his wonderful book, 12 Keys to the Effective Church, talking about how to strengthen your programs, he says, strengthen your strengths. Work on your strengths and make them even better. The common notion is, well, we do that okay, let's start doing these other things. But work on deepening that well that's already there for those folks. But then I would say also, maybe start drilling another one. Maybe not three or four or five, but start drilling another one and have that go along with the deep well that's already there. We can get frustrated with our folks and say, oh, I wish you were over here where I'd like you to be. I think we need to sit back and listen to them and be appalled to our folks and allow them to be who they are with integrity, but then start to enrich that well, feed it with another source.
I think that's really good advice, because I sense that many church communities are much more diversified, actually, in their orientations than our image of a church. You know, like when you're in a historic Norwegian Lutheran congregation, that takes on the flavor of a place when people talk about themselves. But actually, when you start asking people where they come from,
yeah,
it's very diverse.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And then, so then the dimension of that base is kind of more elusive, actually, than real.
I find that whenever whenever I get complaints about choosing unfamiliar hymns. Well, unfamiliar to whom? Yeah. I mean, they're unfamiliar to you, but they're familiar to this faction over here. And I choose a hymn that's familiar to you, and it's unfamiliar to them. And,
when I was called to the Wisconsin rural congregation, 450 people up in the country, the village is 150 people. But in the interview, I asked them about the makeup of the congregation. I remember them saying that we're a farming congregation. We're a congregation of dairy farmers. And they believed that. I believed that. We went on that way when I got there. And we did a study once. And out of 450 members in the congregation, we had 13 dairy farm families. That's all. It used to be many years ago, but it wasn't anymore. Uh-huh. Huh. It was much, much more diverse than anybody thought.
Amazing. Julie has a book of Gerhard Frost. He was a pastor at the church I was at in Minneapolis and had taught at Luther Northwestern Seminary. He died while I was there, and I was privileged to know him for just a short time. Marvelous man. But he would always say, it takes the whole church to say the name Jesus. And how many times do we find ourselves in the position to always have to say it all ourselves? I mean, we can't, as a congregation, be all things to all people. I think we have to say, this is what we do well. We'll try to do more things well, but we can't do everything. It takes the whole church to say the name Jesus, and I think that's a good thing to remember. And even the Lutherans have to admit that maybe the UCC can help say the name too.
notice he said maybe.
But we're just one little speck in the whole history of the church, and we need to remember our place in that. One final quote in a marvelous book that I only read a couple weeks before I came and hadn't had time yet to digest. Where did I write that down? 6. This has to do with metaphor, and worship is praise and empowerment. And this, I'm going to read about half a page here. The power of metaphor resides in its capacity to evoke another world. I don't know if he would mean an otherworldly other world. Maybe another. Well, I'll let him speak for himself. To evoke another world. Metaphors can hold together the two realities of the divine and the human, the sacred and the profane, without losing either. As such, they can be vehicles of transcendence in our age. Both word and sacraments in worship are best understood, therefore, as metaphors. As metaphors, they do not only provide information about one reality or another, they enable participation in the realities of both the human and the divine at once. The power of metaphor is not that of physical force or univocal speech. It is the power of indirection. This is this, and this is not that, which always allows reality to remain other and mysterious. Worship celebrates the future God has in store for the world as present, even before that future is fully actualized. As a metaphor of the not yet, in the now, it has revolutionary power to overturn existing worlds in the manner of Jesus' parables in the reign of God. In this age of power, when various revolutionary forces are at work, including that of Marxism, worship too can be understood as a power for freedom and change in the world. It is a power that, unlike many of the revolutions of our day, keeps life human in the midst of change, because life is most human when it acknowledges its source in the creative will of a gracious and loving God. Worship acknowledges this givenness in an act of praise. At the same time, by celebrating God's gift of life as a call into the future God has in store for the world, worship empowers people for living in the world as agents of the love and justice that characterize the reign of God. Worship, therefore, is both praise and empowerment. That doesn't make you want to read this. I don't know about it. Marvelous. That's all. Mm-hmm.
Newman.
I might add that the handout I gave to you is one chapter of a book on the phenomenon of worship by Marianne Mix, a little brown book I have here. If you ever have study groups that want to kind of deal with a lot of different aspects of worship, that is kind of a hard book to read, but it is the only source I have found that deals with lots of different aspects of just the phenomenology of worship. And I gave you just one chapter of 20, because it actually deals with touch and feeling, and tasting and smelling.
Will that be on the bibliography that Carol sent?
Yeah, but you can get a flavor of that in the chapter I handed out to see if its style is appropriate to study groups or whatever.
Does that address everything you mentioned?
Songs,
listening, what people's gift songs and the type of songs. And I know we're short on time. We do want to make sure that just take a few moments to hear from you, any of your loose end thoughts, reflections, feedback on what we've done, any of that, just a chance for.
Well, I'm glad that David said that he didn't subscribe wholly to that worship as evangelism. I did, because I don't know. I have problems with that. So.
But I think we need to keep that as a challenge to us, to make sure our worship is public
and hospitable to the saints.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I don't think, as Phyllis talked about her experience in the Unity Church, I don't think ultimately it does the strangers any favors to just cater to that. I mean, that's like eating candy. You get enough of that, and you want a more substantive meal. Yeah.
That's the M&M's. If it's M&M's, yes. That's...
Sure. Yeah. Gary, let me just make a quick apology. In this group, this was one Unity Church.
Sure.
And I would hope that you all would not have listened to my sharing and continue to put the Unity Church
under
in the place
leadership
that
particularly.
It seems to be in, and acknowledge that it really has a mission and does meet the needs of some people. I just need to say that, because I feel as if I have presented a pretty bleak picture.
I think it describes a type of church, though.
I agree.
If not a denomination, a type of church.
We have that in the Lutheran Church as well. Mm-hmm.
Well, I enjoyed this week. My horizons have been broadened a little bit, in the whole worship experience, whether it's the building or whether it's the movement or the music, that kind of thing. It gives me some places to explore a little further ideas and thoughts and what can be done, that kind of thing. I enjoy that. We were talking about heaven a little earlier, and one of my strongest images of heaven is being in the presence of God and having all these questions that I've been with and growing up and exploring the world, and having the opportunity not just to know, not to all of a sudden just know everything, but that experience of learning that and getting those questions answered. And Holden's been a little bit of that heaven. Exploring those questions and learning. So I've thoroughly enjoyed this week and meeting everyone.
I don't believe there's anything such as coincidence, that everything is, God's got his hand in every, her. God's hands in.